Welcome back, everybody. This is Eric here with IRAC Veteran 8888. Today, we've got another Gun Gripe episode for you, and we have a special guest here with us today, or with me today, because it's just me with a special guest. I've got Mr. Stephen Gutowski from the Washington Free Beacon. Great journalist, really good writer. He's put out some great articles. You should definitely go subscribe over on Twitter. You know, follow him and Free Beacon over on Twitter. Check out some of their articles. Really, really good information. Today's Gun Gripe episode is going to be about, is gun confiscation practical? Could gun confiscation ever occur in America? And we're going to get into a lot of data points from his article and of course, some opinion thrown in there for fun as well. We know that the short answer is no, but we're going to tell you why the answer is no.
Right.
Why the answer is no. So
yeah, and it's not to say that nobody wants that, because certainly there are people who do want to try and confiscate guns. That's a reality in America. There are groups in the political world who want that. I mean, you saw Beto O'Rourke at the debates, the Democratic debates this summer, and they've gone away from saying nobody wants to take your guns to saying literally, hell yes, we want to come and at least take your AR-15s and AK-47s, right? But the question is, can they do that practically? Let's say in some nightmare scenario, this, you know, they repealed the Second Amendment, they passed a law to send people out to collect guns. What would that actually look like in real life? Like, how practical is that to accomplish, given the number of firearms owned by civilians in the United States? And frankly, I mean, the bottom line, as you said, is that it's not practical. It's not a thing that's realistic. And I don't just mean because the people in America would be far less likely to comply with, a gun turn-in program, but I mean, like,
plot twist,
physically,
they won't.
And of course, that's true. We're far less likely to comply than somewhere like Australia or New Zealand, right? We saw recently where their gun bans and their confiscation efforts were fairly popular and had a lot of people voluntarily comply with them. You are almost certainly not going to, I mean, you're definitely not going to see that sort of compliance here in the United States.
I think there's certainly an enshrined duty that we kind of have as American citizens, right? There's that patriotism factor that comes into effect that doesn't really exist anywhere else in the world. Now, not to say, not to be unfair to all of our brothers and sisters all around the world that are pro-gun and that love guns and that feel that gun ownership is a fundamental human right,
right,
as it is. Absolutely. I view it as a fundamental human right,
a
human right across the entire planet. But America is a special little experiment when it comes to the sanctity of the Second Amendment and what it means to us as a culture, mm-hmm. how we were brought up as people, how our country was founded. So our roots are very deep. And of course, America in general on the global stage has always been regarded, in my opinion, my humble opinion, as this pesky weed that every time they pull, we just grow back because our roots are so deep and that mm-hmm. our conviction is so firm and solid, and our foundation is so solid that that can't be gotten rid of. So I think that there is an underlying duty that American citizens have in the back of their mind, even if they're not vocal about it, even if they don't make a big deal about it. There's that sort of bravado that we have that we won't be ruled, because that's how we were founded as a country. We were exactly. trying to escape persecution. We were trying to escape religious persecution, unfair taxes, all sorts of things, unfair rules. We wanted to govern ourselves, right? So there is that factor there.
Oh, absolutely. And in addition to that, the United States is unique in the sense that we were founded on an armed revolution, right, which was sparked off by essentially a gun confiscation effort. That's what conquered was fought over. The British troops were coming to confiscate the armory there from the militiamen, and that's essentially what sparked the revolution. So there is obviously a unique American history here when it comes to things like gun confiscation. So I absolutely think that if something like that ever did happen, where we passed a law similar to New Zealand or Australia, the results would be vastly different. There would be far less compliance, for one. But that's not even the main reason why it's an impractical idea to begin with, because what really makes it impractical in the United States is that we have 400 million guns that are in civilian hands here by the best estimates. Now, obviously,
we got to get those numbers up, y'all. That's rookie numbers. Come on.
But, we don't have a gun registry for good reason, right? So we don't know, we don't have an actual tally of how many guns there are in the United States, but that's the best estimates from the Small Arms Survey. And they believe the most recent estimate was 400 million guns, which is more guns in civilian hands than there are people in the United States, right? But I think people might know this number offhand, or they might understand that there's hundreds of millions of guns in the US, but I don't think they really understand what that number means, especially in comparison to some other figures. Like, for instance, the US citizens own more firearms than the entire world's military combined, small arms. Like, that's where we're at. That's how big that number is. People don't get that.
Makes me feel good.
It's so
I'm sorry,
so much beyond what I think people understand. And so in the United States, the other estimate from Small Arms Survey is that police own about a million firearms. In police arsenals, there's about a million firearms. So civilians in the United States have 400 times as many firearms as the entire police force of the entire country. So that right there gives you an idea of why it's so impractical to say, to have this fantasy that you could round up all the civilian owned firearms. And, you know, obviously,
if we let them, that's the only way it would happen. Turn them in.
There are people who really think that they could do this. They don't understand it. And this is what I mean by it's completely impractical. And beyond that, let's say, okay, well, they're just talking about taking away, you know, AR-15s, AK-47s, what they call assault weapons. The industry calls them modern sporting rifles, right? Well, all right, so that's a much smaller pool of guns, right? 400 million total guns. NSSF, the Trade and Association for the Firearms Industry, they estimate that there are about 16 million AR-15s and AK-47s in civilian hands in the United States.
So that's still 16 times as many as what the police have.
The entire police force.
And that's just one country. Model, like one general model of a firearm.
So this category of guns, right, there's 16 times as many of those alone in the United States as there are police firearms total. Yeah. And let's just say, so you know, New Zealand, when they passed their gun confiscation bill just recently after the Christchurch shooting, right? And it was very popular. It passed through almost unanimously in that country. So you have something that's super popular there. You're likely to get a lot of compliance. They had about a 10% compliance rate. Their estimates were the initial turn-in was about 10% of what the guns that were supposed to be turned in were. And so if you take, and as we already talked about, the rate of compliance in the United States would be almost certainly be far lower. I mean, we've seen, just for one example, New Jersey, they passed a magazine ban. They lowered their limit from 15 rounds to 10 rounds and made it illegal to possess anything that you'd already had. So that's confiscation, right? You're supposed to turn it in. That's the idea in New Jersey, right? So you can see some examples on a small level of this kind of thing happening here. And so you can get an idea of what Americans actually, how they act when these things happen. Can you guess how many people actually turned in magazines in New Jersey? In New Jersey, right? Deep blue state. Very gun friendly there. Not how many magazines got turned into the state police?
I would venture to guess, okay, that probably about the same amount of people that turned in bump stocks, mm-hmm. which is next to nothing. Like almost such a small number that it's not even worth mentioning.
Literally.
There's not been very many bump stocks turned in.
No, that's true too. That's another good example. But in New Jersey, state police, there was a FOIA where they were asked how many magazines were turned in. And the answer was literally zero. So that just gives you, just on a small scale, how Americans comply. You could look at something like the SAFE Act in New York, which doesn't even require you to turn in your guns. That's just a registration act. And that had super low compliance as well. You know, so you can look in the United States. But let's go with, maybe everyone's going to change their minds. Something happens. Everybody changed their mind. And we get closer to that New Zealand rate where they're New Zealand, you know, this was a popular idea there, but they still only got 10% compliance. 10% compliance of AR-15, AK-47 turn-ins, that's, 1.6 million guns, which is a lot of guns. But that leaves, 14 plus million left on the streets. Even if you got to 90% compliance of just AR-15s, you would still have more AR-15 and AK-47s in civilian hands, even with 90% compliance on a turn-in program, that there would be just in AKs and ARs alone, more of those in civilian hands after a 90% turn-in than all of the police guns combined. Because remember, all police guns and all the police forces in the United States, that equals about 1 million small arms. So there would still be, even with 90% compliance, you would still have more ARs and AKs in civilian hands than there are total arms and police
forces. I would venture to wonder on that metric when you talk about the amount of guns that are just in law enforcement hands. I bet that a huge portion of those guns are handguns. Because, you know, most policemen sure. use a pistol as their service weapon or as their sidearm or whatever for, you know, handling their duties. And I'm not going to say where we are precisely, but like here in, you know, in rural areas in Georgia, there's still a lot of police departments and different municipalities throughout rural Georgia, you know, especially my state, that, you know, their armories, you know, they don't have MP5s and machine guns, and they don't have... You know, they might have some old, you know, Remington 870s and a couple of old, you know, Model 700, you know, hunting rifles, like Woodstock hunting rifles and stuff. And maybe, I don't want to go too far down this rabbit hole because I don't want to call anyone out, but I visited a police armory recently and they had 4 MP5s in their armory, all of them requiring major service, and it didn't work. None of them were functional. They all had tags on them that said, you know, broken extractor, rollers out of spec, and they don't even have an armorer that can work on those things anyway. So I'm not trying to, like, you know, make a big deal about it, but it's important to I think the distinction to make as well is you're not talking 1 million ARs. You're talking, you know, 650,000 Glocks,
right,
and various pistols and some shotguns and rifles thrown in there. And you got to think that firearm, in terms of what that terminology would sort of constitute, would also mean like gas launchers and non-lethal and possibly even tasers and things like that. Now, there are a lot of police departments that obviously are very almost militant, but they are militarized in especially in the big cities.
Well,
you know, yeah, they've
units.
Got a variety of, you know, machine guns, and they've got NRAPs, and they've got, you know, all of these Humvees and stuff. And yeah, I mean, there's probably a police department or two that's got a Ma Deuce or a 240 laying around. But that's the exception, not the rule.
Yeah.
I mean, I think.
Well, certainly, like, that's how the general policing is done, right? You have special units that have more advanced training and more advanced weaponry, SWAT units, yeah. SRT units.
But that figure still counts all of those small arms.
Oh, yeah. It's an estimate, so we don't have an exact number even with police guns. But the estimates, that's the best estimates that we have. And that they show you just the massive disparity between civilian-owned firearms in the United States and really every other kind of firearm. Civilians in the United States own almost 40% of the world's entire arsenal in small arms.
So, a lot, like, of guns.
People maybe understand that there are a lot of guns in the United States, but they don't really get what that means, especially in comparison to the military, even our own military, or even the entire world.
Yeah, the global stage. You look at Canada and their long gun registry. I mean, so Canada experimented with a long gun registry, and it failed miserably because it was so much money for them to maintain and to keep, you know, people. Yeah, they have to have, you know, people they hire and money they have to spend in order to maintain a registry. And it got so crazy, they were like, you know what, screw it, we're not doing it. And then they dropped the registry. So the reason I mentioned Canada's long gun registry is because in the United States, we don't have a registry for, you know, just standard firearms at large. So when we talk about this, you know, 400, you know, million gun number that we start looking at, that's actually, it's not a super accurate number. It's an estimate. And when we talk about registration, when you look at certain municipalities that require registration, like you look at the SAFE Act and you look at New York and how, oh, we're not going to tell you can't have it, but you have to register it. Registration is the first step of confiscation. And I think that's a paradigm that many people tend to not really value or understand or maybe think about. You know, they think that this gun confiscation is just going to come in the form of, you know, a guy in a van, some dudes in a van showing up to your home and going, all right, well, we know you're in there. Give us the guns. No, I mean, I think that their idea, at least the way that in a perfect world, in a dystopian environment, the way that they would love to see it happen is to show up with a list and go, yeah, we need serial number, blah, 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 this and this. We know you got this, 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 and this. Here's this list. You're going to produce these or else. Right. That's what they want. So,
like Red Dawn.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. So, yeah, in Red Dawn, you know, the Cuban general goes to the gun store and gets the 44-73s, and there it is, you know. So there is a very scary environment of storm that is brewing when it comes to confiscation. Not that confiscation could occur, but not to say that they won't attempt every try they can at registration. Now, the reason I mention that as well is, I don't know if you are aware of this or not, they recently changed the 4473. I don't know if y'all have noticed that. All of the identifying information of the gun owner, address, name, and the guns that are on the form are now on the front page of the 4473. Now, I know what you're thinking. They are not supposed to maintain a database of 4473s. All right. Now, I have a hard time believing that when a NICS check goes through on, you know, digital, like when you go to a big box store and you put in all your information and submit it, that it's not held in some form of database. I find that very hard to believe, especially being digital. But why would they want all that information on the front of one page, right? So they don't have to flip and do all this mess. They can just, I think the reason, even though they won't admit it, and even though it's technically they're not supposed to maintain a database of 4473s, I think the plan is when they go in to audit these gun stores, and they're going through and checking 4473s, I think they're going to bring a little scanner with them. They're going to scan that first page, and they're going to start doing a registry. Because...
Well, it would be a federal felony.
It would be, but... It doesn't mean they won't do it. The point I'm making, though, is that with the advent of document scanning technology, the technology we have now, like when you do your taxes and you're scanning receipts and stuff, it is so detailed and so precise that it can act, these document scanning software and hardware interfaces can actually scan that document and then just compile all that data into a database, and then the document itself doesn't matter what happens to it. It then becomes digital and it becomes searchable. It's very advanced technology. And I'm not trying to scare people into thinking that's what they will, that what they want to do or what they will do. It's just that the change of the 4473 puts that thought kind of in the back of my mind that it's something that could be abused in the future.
Yeah. I mean, in the future, you could see, like, that's the thing. As things stand now, right, we don't have that federal database. So in order to build something like that, they would have to go through to every gun store and get all of those old 4473s, which would be a huge undertaking. But that gives you another idea of, like, in practice, how would you go about trying to enforce gun confiscation rule? Well, it would be really hard because as things stand now, they don't know exactly who has the guns or what guns they have. And so the most recent polling from Pew suggests that there are 120 million people in the United States who report having a gun in their home.
That's just who reported it.
Sure. But that's who said, you get a little bit lower rate when you ask directly if someone owns a gun. But when you ask, is there a gun in your home? So, like, maybe there's a husband and wife, and the husband is the one who owns the gun, but the wife lives in that home with the gun. And so that's 120 million households.
Well, what's hers is hers, and what's yours is hers. You better remember that. It's the key to a happy life.
But so you've got to find, if you wanted to try and take away all of the guns, and even if you just wanted to take away some subset, like AR-15s, right?
Right.
You'd still have to figure out who the hell has them, right?
Yeah.
And then go and find them. And that's a lot of people you're going to have to go through and try to find their firearms, which amounts to such an incalculable amount. Like, you deal with big numbers, right?
Yeah.
People just, it sort of glosses over. But the reality is 400 million guns, or even just 15 or 16 million firearms, like, collecting all this, even if everybody wanted to turn them in, that would be a nightmare to do.
16 million of anything is a lot of something. It doesn't matter if you're collecting 16 million coins or 16 million guns or 16 million trash bags. 16 million of anything is a lot.
It's an unimaginable number. Like, you know, the military has only, I believe the number was 3 million small arms in the U.S. military. So, you know, think about all of the logistics that go into storing military small arms. And then just for ARs alone, you'd have to multiply that by 5.
Oh, they'd run them through a wood chipper and they're not going to store them.
But even doing that would take forever. Like,
No, they'll sell them to Mexico, to the cartels. That's what they'll do. Ah, yeah, that's right.
But so like,
thanks Obama.
The practicality of it. There's so many reasons why these people who think we could just get rid of all the guns in the United States if we really tried or whatever, they're just living in a fantasy world.
I think there's a double-edged sword as well. And I think we'll sort of close this gripe with these few statements, but I think this is pretty pertinent too. Now, I mean, I try to be really fair in these videos, right? I like to put things out in a way that people understand where I'm coming from and know that I'm not trying to play favorites, but I mean, I obviously have an opinion just like any other red-blooded American, but when you look at, and look, this is facts, right? I mean, this isn't about me not liking Democrats or liking Democrats, but when you look at the Democrats, I mean, they're obviously all over social media calling for, oh, defund the police, you know, but in the same breath, only the police should have guns. So they're anti-gun and they think only the police should have guns, but then they want to defund the police. And then they want to call the police when there's a problem, when, you know, they call, and they're the ones that call the police the most anyway. But then on top of that, so you want those same police that you're out there saying, you know, all this heinous stuff about law enforcement, and you want them to risk their life to go around and enforce your dystopian gun control efforts. That's not how it works. Okay, so if every single law enforcement officer at large in the United States decided, okay, the answer is yay, we will do it. We will undertake this crusade and we'll do it. Still wouldn't be enough. And you think for 1 second that there's not going to be, I'm optimistic, but I think 65 to probably 75% of law enforcement is going to call in with the barf and farts that day. They're not going to do that. Why would they risk their life for someone who hates them? The side of the political aisle that wants to see them hurt and defunded and disarmed and everything else. So it becomes an issue of ethics and morals and principles. And it's like they are so far apart on those types of issues that they're disenfranchising the people they want to come take our guns. That ain't ever going to work. I don't care who you are. No one's going to. If I'm going to risk my life for somebody knowingly and go into a situation, it's definitely going to be a situation that I'm at least going to know what I'm getting into and know why I'm doing it. You know, they're not stupid. They're still human beings just like anybody else. Absolutely. I mean, they've got families. They've got homes. They're human beings just like anybody else. So, of course, they're not going to knowingly go into the fray for people that hate them. Right. So there is a cultural disposition too, mm-hmm. that I believe is not conducive to the police going around and rounding up firearms in public hands at large.
And a lot of police officers to that point are some of the most pro-gun people you'll meet.
Many of them are.
You almost certainly would not get a very large percentage of police officers on board with something. Not that you won't get any, but so there's certainly some very anti-gun.
But I think by the time you factor that in, you know, that difference in the amount of people who are willing and not willing, that metric becomes even more insane.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Because now you've got even less manpower, even less willing people. And then once some, you know, let's just say some skirmishes and ugly things start happening, which will happen, it's inadvertently will happen because it's just writing on the wall, then it's going to be even worse. It's going to be a downward spiral of consequences that will quickly end in them going, just like Canada, and going, you know what, this just isn't worth it. It's a series of diminishing returns, and it's not worth it.
And the other thing, too, I think is important to note is like, well, okay, so if door-to-door confiscation isn't realistic, does that mean we just don't need to worry about anything? I don't think that's the case at all. What you need to worry about most realistically are things like what the SAFE Act or New Jersey's magazine ban, where essentially they'll pass these laws, these bans on possession, not just future sales, right? But you can't even have the ones you already have, right? And then what they'll do is nothing. They just won't try to enforce it. That's what New Jersey did. They passed that law. And then if you get caught with one, maybe generally what happens is you do some serious crime and, oh, you murdered a guy and you happen to have a 11-round magazine in your gun when you murdered him,
right?
You get the tack on charge. But it can also be like a selective enforcement kind of thing, you know, where that charge can be hanging over your head. Maybe the vast majority of people never get charged with it, like bump stocks, you know.
Yep.
But if some law enforcement guy has it out for you and you happen to have one of these things that got banned, well, sure, we don't usually prosecute this, but we got you on that. So That's the more realistic thing to me, is what you could see happen. Like, ARs get made illegal to possess. They don't try. They make some, you know, we'll have a buyback, and you get like 1% people turn them in. And then everyone else, it's just like, well, you happen to be a felon now. And then once they decide, someone just catches you with it or decides that they want to make a big deal about it, they can charge you. And that's where the danger comes. Less so in like, we're going to, you know, send thugs to your door and go door to door. More like, you're going to have to live with the reality that keeping that firearm you bought, and it was legal when you bought it and you didn't do anything different, and then suddenly it became illegal, you'll have to worry for the rest of your life that maybe someone comes along and pops you on it.
You're precisely correct on that. It will end up being like a tack on charge. And I think, not to say, I don't support gun control at all. I think that all forms of gun control are unconstitutional. You know, I'm a straight up constitutionalist in that regard. Most gun control, most gun laws, at best, cannot pass constitutional purview in a million years. And that's one light at the end of the tunnel we have, is that with the new Supreme Court pick, let's hope that, you know, and at the time this video is being filmed, is amidst of a new Supreme Court justice being, you know, nominated or whatever. So let's hope that we have some light at the end of the tunnel, that there's a chance that a lot of this stuff will get struck down in the Supreme Court. But another aspect, too, is a very similar paradigm, is the sort of federal battle on cannabis. Okay, you look at, like, for instance, here in the city of Atlanta, cannabis possession under an ounce is decriminalized. Okay. But other parts of Georgia, if you go to rural Georgia, where it's, you know, you're in the Bible Belt and people are more religious and way, way more conservative, so it is a two-way street. Then, and they catch you with even the tiniest amount of some substance, they're going to throw you under the jail. So it's kind of weird to see that paradigm where I go to Atlanta and I'm a gun owner, I'm treated as a criminal. Someone in Atlanta who's a cannabis user comes to rural America, gets treated as a criminal. It's like, it's backwards. And sometimes you just wonder, and I don't care what someone's opinion might be on the legalization of cannabis, but you would think that the Republicans, from a political standpoint, would be like, hey, you know, here's something that a heck of a lot of Americans really want, this legalized, and there's a heck of a lot of Americans just want to be left alone with their gun rights. You sure would think that there would be a political candidate that would be like, hey, you know, we're going to give everybody what they want and just... You know, but we're going to hold you accountable to your actions, what you actually do, the things you do. It doesn't matter what you put in your body, what your mental disposition may be. Every person is judged by their actions and what they do. I mean, and nothing will ever change that. No law, no political party. You know, people will have always been and will always be judged by what they do. And, you know, no matter what side of the law you sit on in terms of your position on firearms or recreational drug use or medicinal drug use or whatever, it still comes down to someone using those particular items and then doing something wrong, either while under the influence or while in the case of a firearm, being in possession of a firearm and committing a crime. You're not really judged until you commit a crime. And that's how it should be, right? I mean, someone, if you're not committing, you know, if you haven't created a victim, then you haven't committed a crime. I mean, that's the way I have to look at it. But, you know, am I wrong? Possibly. Are there people that disagree with me? Of course there are. But I always try to Spock things. Like, I think like Spock would think, like, does it pass my logic test, my Spock logic test? You know, and if the little Spock pops up on my shoulder and says, that's highly illogical, well, I have to sort of kind of rethink it a bit. And that's kind of where I am on that issue.
Sure. But I mean, if people want to, you know, check all the facts that we talked about today, I wrote a piece for the Washington Examiner a while back that they can check out.
Check it out.
And then we have that gun gripes episode as well on the Supreme Court. So
I don't know what order these episodes are going to go up, but we do have an episode with Steve and I on the Supreme Court pick. So check that out if you haven't. We've also had him as a guest on our Life, Liberty, and Pursuit podcast. Make sure you check that out. It's a like hour and 15 minute show. We dive into a bunch of great stuff. So if you want to learn more about the Washington Free Beacon and about Stephen's work, definitely check that podcast out as well. Again, make sure you go over on Twitter. Subscribe to him, follow him, follow the Washington Free Beacon. I think it's very refreshing, on a side note before we leave here today, it is refreshing to see a group of writers like that the Washington Free Beacon is really doing a good job of really getting into the soul of a situation and being unbiased and fair. And it's refreshing to see solid reporting being done, especially in the gun paradigm, which Stephen is one of the few holding the front lines in the journalism world when it comes to trying to be fair to gun owners. Mm. So we definitely appreciate that, and we support his efforts. And I would encourage you to support what they're doing as well if you can. You know, at least go and follow them, engage in the articles, comment, share, anything algorithmically we can do to get these values and these ideas out there in a more public forum. That's the biggest battle that we're honestly fighting, is the cultural battle. Laws are what they are. Laws will change as culture changes, but we must change culture. We must change the minds of culture at large to accept our ideas and to see it as a normal thing. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I really appreciate you being on the Gun Gripes here with me today.
This was fun.
Yeah, this was great. So we're going to have Stephen back, and we hope you enjoyed today's video. Thank you so much for tuning in. Appreciate you watching. Go over on Ballistic Ink, pick yourself up a snazzy t-shirt. We'd really appreciate it. Those of you who support us on Patreon, thank you so very much for supporting us. Also, we've got some great man cans for sale. If you love the channel, you love what we do, and you want to support us, those are the most direct ways you can do so. We'll see you soon. Many more videos on the way, and we've been talking about our next meltdown videos, so we have more meltdowns on the way. I promise, they're coming. I got to break out the flak jacket and the mask and chew up some ammo. As you can imagine, it's kind of hard right now, but we're going to make it happen. All right, have a good one. See you next time.